think I did this once before, not the dual member thing, but hi, I'm Chris Q. I go to Full Monty and Queen Anne and Wedgwood Men, and for my Al-Anon, I go to Counterbalance. Those are all, well, two of them are Queen Anne meetings, one's the U District. I recognize a ton of you guys, and it's really interesting to look out, and, well, it's not interesting, it's actually heartwarming, I guess, to look out and know that, you know, out of all the people in these rooms, how many interactions I've had with people that have been, you know, as meaningful as they have. I mean, it's not just, you know, if you guys were just a bunch of guys that I drank with, I would have probably, well, I bitched about this with that guy and fucking talked about that bitch with this other person. And it's just like, you know, what does that get me? Well, here. So, on that, I'll try to keep the history part brief. I think that, you know, I'll say that, you know, a big part of my story is sex, and then, you know, I've done a lot of therapy along with the program, so if you don't like therapy, well, too bad for you. you know, I grew up with parents. My father was an alcoholic and quit drinking, I think, when I was about 10. And my mom was an Al-Anon. Okay, so neither one of my parents did any kind of recovery work. That's just not where they came from. And I'm gradually starting to accept that, you know. Unfortunately, you know, part of recovery and part of the acceptance of other people is, I'm just a link in a chain, and, you know, it's not that anybody else really did anything terrible. It's just that I've been blessed with being able to come here and being able to be a part of Al-Anon and AA and get away from it. You know, I'm the exception. The rule is, for whatever reason, my parents and their parents and their parents' parents just didn't happen. So I'll try to make it quick. You know, growing up, like I said, my father, practicing alcoholic till I was 10, quit drinking. I don't remember a ton about my father's drinking. When he quit, he just quit. No AA. So as far as like having an example of, you know, the white knuckle thing that I absolutely don't want to do, he was that. In my recovery, I'd seen a guy who, you know, it's kind of the inverse of AA and Al-Anon. You know, to me, the idea of coming to Al-Anon and AA or AA and Al-Anon was to be able to somehow safely make my world bigger, to make my experience more than it was, because it was just small. I was drinking. I was frightened. I didn't always know why, and it was just real easy to make the world small, and that's what I saw my father do. That was his answer. It was like he didn't figure out how, as much as he was a responsible provider and as much as, you know, I had a roof over my head and all that stuff, but I saw a guy who just had a real hard time dealing with stuff, and that wasn't for me. So as my father, I guess, was absent, you know, some of this stuff I have to say is sort of speculation. I don't really know a lot of what happened. But as my father was drinking, I think I became the focus of my mother's attention, or should I say, I was a replacement for my father. And instead of just kind of being able to be a kid and be noticed for whatever, you know, all the touchy-feely, good, healthy upbringing stuff, I was supposed to pay attention to her, and it really was just not about me. And as an adult, that's the way life is, but I think as a kid, the idea, at least as I've come to understand it, is you focus on the kid, and the kid gets self-esteem, and then they actually get to become an adult, whereas I didn't get that, and as a result, struggled to become an adult. In fact, you know, I don't know that I really became an adult until, I'm 44, so maybe sometime in the middle of last year, maybe I was an adult. You know, it's all relative. So I had that, and I didn't, you know, like was said before, I had all the stuff, and I certainly wasn't want for clothes or food or, you know, my parents put me through college, and but I just didn't really get, I'm without blaming them, I just think historically in my family, it really wasn't about, I don't think, people don't need to be loved and recognize and do all that stuff to survive and have kids and just fucking get on with it. Like, it's not an evolutionary necessity. Let's just put it that way. As I think most of us can attest to, it's like families can go on being miserable for generations, no problem. So, you know, it's not essential. It's not an essential thing to be whole. If you know, so there's that. But as a result for me, I just grew up not feeling important, not feeling just kind of whole, not feeling recognized and all this stuff. And then on top of that, I mean, I was recognized as the oldest son and I think in some ways, but it was also, there was also a lot of pressure. And then at about 10, I was having some learning trouble and I was diagnosed as dyslexic, which didn't really help. And at a certain point, I don't know what was going on in my parents' relationship. I think at that point, my dad may have been having affairs. And, you know, I was just a kid. There was stuff going on in the house. I didn't know what the fuck it was. I didn't even know. I have kind of a better idea these days, but something was going on that affected me. And around the same time, you know, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, and it was just kind of, I just felt like a failure. And shortly after that, I discovered drinking. And I'll say, you know, that the first part of the thing with me was the Al-Anon part. That was, you know, I didn't know how to process my emotions. I didn't know how to deal with people. And, you know, what I thought didn't matter. I was good at reaction. I watched my parents be in reaction to each other all the time. I didn't watch them actually resolve things. So I never picked that up. And at about 12, I discovered alcohol, which was fucking great. Like, you know, I think most of us know. For a while, I could numb out and not have those problems. And seemingly kind of go on with life. And just kind of continue to get more and more diluted. And, you know, a big part of my story, and I don't know, again, if it had to do with my relationship with my mother. It probably did. I've gone through stuff about emotional incest and all this other stuff. You know, and I'm going to own that. That's part of my story, the whole sex thing. And you know, thanks to this program and Al-Anon, I get to keep working on that. And I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm through it, but I'm in a place where at least I'm on a path, whereas before I was just fucking bewildered. All the time. I didn't know why women frightened me so much. I mean, I could seemingly drink, get into a situation, you know, date somebody for a while, sleep with somebody for a while, do whatever. Seemingly, you know, I'm a musician and all that stuff. So from the outside, it probably seemed like, well, that guy's got it made or whatever. But I just, you know, emotional connections and the ongoing thing, I just didn't have what it took. And, you know, to this day, it's still like, I don't know, you know, but I, like I said, I'm on a path. So that's a big part of my story. Incredibly awkward around, you know, at this age, they were still girls, but I went to college, drank a lot my first couple years of college, and I thought I'd conquered my women stuff because I was sleeping with a lot of them, so obviously no problem there, but I was inebriated, you know, just about all the time. So what I was actually really doing was just digging myself deeper into a hole. And I'd also gone through a period of semi-sobriety, you know, unmonitored white-knuckle sobriety in the 90s for about 5 years. And my problem, again, my problems with women and that whole thing, just it didn't really, it was the same. In fact, without the alcohol, a lot of times it was worse. So, you know, as a result, I just knocked. I've had different relationships and just had the same intimacy problems around sex, and that just kind of kept going on. And then I think that in 06, when I got sober, that was, I guess it was a little less than a year after my last kind of failed relationship that I had had. And I, for whatever reason, I guess I just, something was wrong, and I knew it. And, you know, I'd kind of not really drank for about 5 years, from about 95 to about 2000, picked up again in 2000 and drank till 06. And there were a couple times where I thought I could quit, and I couldn't. And I just, it just had its hands around my throat in a way that it hadn't before. And, you know, so simultaneously, I couldn't deal with my relationship. That fell apart. And, you know, I kind of blamed her, of course, because that's what you do when all else fails and I don't want to look at myself. And I had to quit drinking. I mean, that was the first thing. I mean, first of a lot of stuff, but the drinking was huge. And I ended up in Harborview a couple times, just feeling nuts. Prior, when I was still drinking, I'd gotten a bunch of tax stuff happened, and I just couldn't be an adult and deal with it. I ended up in Harborview. The guy's like, "How much are you drinking?" I said, "A lot." He said, "You know, you might want to think about quit drinking." But, you know, Harborview's like, you know, I don't have a lot of time to tell people how to live their lives. So that happened. I get sober, and then me being me and having my own program, I met somebody in the program within about 2 months of getting sober, and ended up getting married about a year and a half later. And that wasn't easy, but I can't say it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, because, I mean, that was a big push to do a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have done otherwise. And, you know, thank God I didn't drink over it. During that time, it was always, what's the one thing I can do to make my life better? What do I need to do? It was like, what's the silver bullet? And so I would do the steps. I was desperate. I was wondering why I felt insane. And I, to try to save my relationship and try to save myself, I did whatever I did a lot of stuff. And then, you know, the relationship fell apart in spite of all that, in spite of therapy, in spite of AA and Al-Anon. But, you know, when it did, even to this day, I'm not happy about it. But at the same time, I think I did everything I could do about it. And that was the whole thing about Al-Anon. I mean, I was also very fortunate in that when I first came into AA, the guy that took me to some of my first meetings is actually here, was doing Al-Anon as well. And him being sort of a cynical, sarcastic personality like I am, it sort of took away the, you know, I didn't thumb my nose at Al-Anon. I know that some people do, which to me is surprising because, you know, if you read the seventh step and talk about humility and doing what you need to do to get through life and stuff, it's just funny to me that somebody would surrender to AA and at least not, again, this is an opinion, at least not maybe save a space mentally or reserve judgment about Al-Anon, because yeah, it's the same, it's a survival thing. It's just, you know, go talk to somebody who doesn't believe in AA and says things like, "Well, I hear, you know, they tell you you're powerless over alcohol." And, you know, you're not powerless over alcohol. And, you know, all right, well, that's, you understand that a certain way, and that's fine. So I get sober, I get married. For some reason, you know, I can't be sober for 2 months and manage, you know, getting married a year and a half later and being in this relationship, and, you know, big surprise. So I start going to Al-Anon, and I start getting some boundaries. I went to a bunch of therapy that sucked, that was really fucking expensive. I took a lot of medication that didn't work for me. And then I found a therapist that worked, that was doing some work in there's an ASP program, and there's a guy named Patrick Carnes who wrote a bunch of books that are very, you know, they're very close to 12 steps and that philosophy. I found a therapist that was versed in that stuff, and I was on a track, and before I wasn't even, like, I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I can't tell, you know, the idea of just the bewilderment that I was facing versus finding Al-Anon, I mean, AA, and being on a track about the alcoholism and hearing what people had to say and relating to that, and then getting into Al-Anon and doing that for a while, and that was a bit harder to understand. And then I just didn't have anything else to do, so I stayed. And then at a certain point, the AA and the Al-Anon sort of, like, I had this, you know, the sum was greater than its parts thing, where they both kind of came together and definitely became greater than each one was just on its own. Like, it just, I don't know, it wasn't a cerebral experience. It was something that kind of happened in my heart. And I just thought, oh, wow. I just felt a lot of relief. And then again, with the therapy, being on some kind of track around these sexual things that kept coming up. You know, my problems weren't solved, but I was going somewhere with them. And I can't tell you what a relief that was. I mean, you know, I'd go to therapy and sit in there, and my therapist would say, well, how do you feel right now? And I'd say, well, I feel like so-and-so is doing this or that, or I feel like my life. She said, that's not a feeling, you know. And she'd point at this chart, and it would say angry, sad. And what I was finding was, you know, things would come up, and my response to most of life's problems was to get depressed, because there was no anger. There was no sad or, you know, am I feeling pain? And I just didn't have any idea of how to divide and conquer these things. It was like things would just fucking hit me, and I would just kind of collapse like a little kid. And, you know, if everything was just one ball of emotion, one depression, you know, just what I'd just think of as kind of depression, it was like I couldn't sort it out. And at least with this, and with Al-Anon having some boundaries, with AA and having some principles and living my life according to some rules, there was no getting through it. And, you know, with the therapy and with the AA and Al-Anon, I could, you know, if I'm angry, I'm angry. So, okay, what am I angry at? Well, I'm angry at this person. Okay, well, if it was a 4-step thing or a 10-step, what are you angry about? Well, what's your part in it? And I was finding that I was working through these things, and it was like my load just became less and less light. More and more light. Because every time something would come up in the past, I'd be angry about whatever it was and completely overwhelmed, but I'd also have all this past stuff with me that was, didn't have anything to do with what was going on. It was just extra stuff that I would connect it, you know, each and every problem that would come up in my life. And I don't have that stuff these days because of that. And I can see life more as just problems that grown-ups have. And they're not, you know, dire. I mean, Dwight had said something about, you know, being able to have something come up, a challenge in life, or something that's maybe not the way I think I want it, yet still live my life. Like, yeah, sure, that's something I can deal with. I've done, you know, and being in these programs means I do things to figure out what's going on with, you know, I need health insurance. That makes me furious, and I'm having a real hard time being a grown-up and facing the fact that I don't have health insurance. That's an example of something I got to deal with. But it's not, you know, I'm still progressing in other areas of my life. It's not like I went to bed last night stressing about health insurance. I'm doing what I can do about it, and that's it. Life goes on. How am I on time? Oh, okay. Wow, good. So, let's see here. So that's a challenge I have today. I'm looking at my list here. And, you know, just I think the main thing is being on track, being part of a program, being a part of a bunch of programs, as opposed to the bewilderment that I faced before. I mean, things aren't always perfect, and that's all right. I can accept that today. You know, it's funny, I'm the kind of guy that I get in these emotional situations where I don't want to return a phone call, and I have this kind of exaggerated thing that I do with myself where I tell myself I'm not going to, I literally go, well, I'm not going to die. Like, I got to call this customer back who may or may not be happy, and I'm always assuming, trying to mind read, or, you know, I go, well, this isn't going to kill me. I can call them. Another thing I can do today, and hopefully this isn't too off base, I can take compliments from people, which is important. Not necessarily even just for me, but the thing is, if somebody's giving you something, it's a gift. You know, A, whatever I'm being complimented isn't necessarily about me. A lot of time it's a gift from somewhere else, and if somebody's complimenting, that's a gift from the person that's... So to just push all that away, I think is sort of... I've come to understand it as not being very grateful for, you know, the people in my life and the gifts I've been given. You know, these programs are a gift. I'm a musician. I'm a pretty good musician. And that's a huge gift. And it's not, the gift isn't that I'm the greatest musician in the world. The gift is just, I get to do that and I get to love what I do. And everything else is gravy. So... let's see. And I think I'll end on this. The one thing that has been sticking with me a lot lately is, you know, the humility it takes to be in these programs and show up. And again, how grateful I feel for being able to be here. And I'm not above having judgment about people that I know that could use these programs and don't. But I do find myself often backing up, and, you know, the real thing about it is it's just so lucky that I'm here. And for whatever reason, stuck with it, because it's not something that I could ever really take credit for. It's not, I did this, I'm so proud. I mean, I'm proud of myself. That's in a healthy way, that for whatever reason, but I can't take credit. And people come in, and I see people come in and out of these programs that are smart, that are, but just don't get it. And I don't know that I'm any different than them. I think it's just I'm lucky. I don't know what it is that keeps people coming in these rooms, and I don't know what it is. You know, it's that extra thing beyond intelligence. It's beyond just thinking I've got a problem and I'm going to somehow quantitatively figure this out and this is what I need to do. It's just, it's beyond that. And, you know, if you've been in here for years or months, consider yourself lucky. If you keep coming, consider yourself lucky, because, you know, things could change. And not a lot of people get this. And I don't know what it is. And, you know, and to me, that's higher power stuff. That's just like, you know, science can figure out all this stuff. Atheists can spend time figuring out why there isn't a God. And that's all fine with me. But I certainly can't explain why things happen and why the people I know in here have made the changes they've made. And it keeps me coming back, and I've seen changes and I've had changes in my life that, even though, like I said, with the sexual stuff and sort of this ongoing stuff in my life, I've seen enough changes in people and I've seen enough changes in myself that I just figure I just got to keep coming. So with that... Thanks.
Thanks very much.